From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the worst vacation ever. It started with overpriced dinners and ended in open-heart surgery. We talk with writer Jeffrey Wolfe. This miserable vacation is one subject in his new collection of essays. Wolfe is best known for his book, The Duke of Deception, a memoir about being the son of a con man. Also today, A is for Amy, who fell down the stairs. B is for Basil, assaulted by bears. We talk with Edward Gorey, the creator of macabre alphabet books and other sinister delights. His book Amphigory has been adapted into a new musical, which just premiered in Philadelphia. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews the restored version of Candide. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The United Nations Security Council demanded today that Libya put a stop to attacks on the embassies of countries that voted in support of the air and weapons sanctions. Demonstrators sacked the Venezuelan embassy and attempted to storm the Russian mission. Diplomats said there were also noisy demonstrations outside the embassies of other countries that voted for the sanctions. They said the attacks and demonstrations appear to have been orchestrated by the government of Colonel Muammar Gaddafi, though he denied that. In New York, a jury has found John Gotti, the head of the Gambino crime family, guilty of all 13 counts of murder and racketeering. Gotti and his co-defendant, Frank Locascio, who was found guilty of all but one count of illegal gambling, face up to life in prison. NPR's Maria Hinojosa reports.
John Gotti had been nicknamed the Teflon Don after three previous government trials ended in acquittals. But today, as the jury forewoman announced the guilty verdicts, Gotti sat motionless with a smirk on his face and then turned to his supporters in the courtroom and said, "I'll be okay." Gotti was found guilty of five murders, racketeering, gambling, loan sharking, and obstruction of justice. During the trial, the jury heard testimony from Salvatore Sammy Bull Gravano, the man who was once second in command of the Gambino mob. Gravano was the highest-ranking mafia member ever to testify against a former boss. During his 9 days on the stand, Gravano detailed the inner workings of the New York-based crime family. The FBI says the guilty verdicts will be a devastating blow to organized crime across the country. Gotti's lawyers plan to appeal the conviction in 30 days. In New York, this is Maria Hinojosa reporting.
Bill Clinton and Jerry Brown took shots at each other during rallies in Manhattan today. The two Democratic presidential candidates are campaigning in New York, which holds its primary next Tuesday. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Clinton and Brown both held rallies today in New York City. While Clinton addressed the Wall Street lunchtime crowd, Brown spoke to New York University students in Washington Square. Clinton blasted Brown's flat tax idea, saying it's the most reactionary proposal ever made in a presidential campaign. And Brown accused Clinton of sabotage, saying the Arkansas governor called a series of debates and he's now backing out of them. While Clinton is way ahead of Brown in the race for delegates, Brown hopes a strong showing in New York will propel his campaign to the June primary in his home state of California. Tomorrow, Clinton heads to Wisconsin, which also holds a primary on Tuesday. Brown is perceived to have an edge there, and Clinton has some catching up to do. It's also a chance for Clinton to get away from the New York City tabloids, which have not been giving him favorable coverage. I'm Elizabeth Arnold in New York.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 15 points to close at 3,234. Declines led advances by 5-3. This is NPR. Panamanian President Guillermo Endara said today that his government will extradite former strongman Manuel Noriega and try him at home if he's acquitted of drug trafficking in the United States. Deliberations are expected to begin tomorrow in Noriega's trial in Miami. The first mission devoted solely to studying Earth's atmosphere is over. The space shuttle Atlantis touched down in Florida this morning after 9 days in space. Dave Pignanelli of member station WMFE reports.
NASA's Associate Administrator for Spaceflight, Leonard Fisk, called it the most successful space lab mission to date. Atlantis spent 9 days studying the various layers of Earth's atmosphere and how the sun influences its delicate balance. Although Fisk remained upbeat throughout a post-landing news conference, he felt it necessary to stress the importance and advantages of a shuttle program over expendable rockets. That comment was an indirect reference to the Bush administration's desires to change the direction of the space program, something something that has forced resignations at the very top levels of NASA. The agency's new administrator, Daniel Golden, followed Fisk and insisted he carried no hidden agenda for the White House. Golden also reiterated his remarks that he made to senators during the confirmation process that he will be in charge of the nation's space agency. For National Public Radio, I'm Dave Pignanelli at the Kennedy Space Center in Florida.
The number of Americans filing new claims for unemployment benefits grew by 9,000 during the first week in March, the second weekly increase in a row. The Labor Department said that the number of people filing first-time claims grew to 456,000 in the week that ended on March 21st. The increase came as a surprise to most economists who'd predicted little change. The biggest increases in new claims came in Texas, New York, and Kentucky. Each of those states reported more than 2,000 people who were newly out of work. The Labor Department said that new claims decreased by more than 5,000 in California. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Jeffrey Wolff, has a new collection of essays that pick up where his best-known book left off. That earlier book, The Duke of Deception, was a memoir about growing up the son of a con man. His father wore the disguise of a refined and wealthy gentleman, but by the time Jeffrey Wolff started his writing career, his father was in prison. Wolff's brother, Tobias, is also an acclaimed writer now, but Tobias and Jeffrey barely knew each other as children since their parents were divorced and Tobias lived with his mother on the opposite coast. Tobias has also written a memoir about growing up, but his was about coming of age with a mother who was flat out broke. Jeffrey Wolff's new collection of essays is called A Day at the Beach. The title essay is about the most miserable vacation he ever had. He was with his family in the Dutch part of the Caribbean island St. Martin. The prices were exorbitant, the beach was too close to the airport, but worst of all, by the time the vacation was over, he needed open-heart surgery.
I meant to write about the heart surgery, being sick. And what I wound up writing about mostly was the worst vacation anybody ever took. That that seems to be characteristic of me. I hate solemnity so much, but I just got more interested in the human drama of it, and the populated narrative was the vacation narrative, not the heart surgery narrative. I kept going back to the origins, not of the heart disease, but of the vacation. How did we get to that benighted island where we were robbed, overcharged, sideswiped? I had some of the great epic battles with my wife that we've ever had in our marriage on that island. And how did it all come to pass? That was the thing that seemed to interest me most.
Why did you want to go there in the first place?
We had flown, God, we'll sound like jet setters here, little Caribbean jet setters. We had flown down to Antigua once to go sailing, and we stopped off in St. Martin. We were with our boys, who were then teenagers, and the airplane was full of absolutely gorgeous, gorgeous, gorgeous teenage girls on the way down, and my sons were beside themselves with pleasure. And we stopped in St. Martin, and all the girls got off. And the only people left on the airplane were old people like us who flew down to Antigua from St. Martin. So their mother said, "Don't worry, boys, someday I'll bring you back here." And so that's what she did. That's how we got there. We were on the hunt for their pleasures.
Well, that'll teach you to think about their pleasures instead of your own.
You bet.
Have you arrived at the conclusion that there are some vacations or some periods of time, some trips that are cursed?
Oh, sure. But this was kind of wonderfully cursed. Everywhere we turned, it was cursed. For example, we were in a condominium that had looked quite appealing in the brochures, and it was at the end of the runway. And of a large airport that had jumbo jets, and it was at the end of the runway where the planes take off, and so it was when they went absolute full throttle, so the noise level can be imagined. What can't be imagined is the effect of being sprayed with jet fuel as you lie on a beach. That you have to experience to appreciate fully.
We should mention you also had the wonderful experience of having to eat $84 pizzas.
Oh, it was extraordinary. They were, I think the pizzas were about $84 a piece, and shrimp about $90 a piece, as I recall. it isn't a place I recommend.
So tell me what happened to you when you got sick.
Well, I just keeled over. I was having a water fight with my sons, and it was vigorous, as water fights apt to be. And it was an hour or two before our plane left. It was our last dip in the ocean. And I began to feel short of breath in the water, and then I couldn't breathe at all. And then the next thing I knew, I woke up in the sand, and there were people... And there were people holding my wrists and other people asking me please not to die until we got home. And then I spent some time in the St. Martin Hospital, which is another experience that I will not soon forget. But it was a genetically deformed heart valve that had just finally occluded and wasn't passing any blood into my brain.
I really understood in the book how you kept telling yourself, well, you'll go through the catheterization, but you know you're not going to need open heart surgery. I think you really need to talk yourself into the fact that you're not going to have to go that far in order to take the first step.
It's odd that it seemed odd at the time that the. It seemed odd at the time that my cardiologist, who was extremely smart, and that he would not tell me anything I wanted to know. He'd only tell me a small thing, and the small thing he'd tell me was what was going to happen next, what was going to happen immediately next, what was going to happen today or tomorrow. But he wouldn't give me what they call the overview, so I had to learn about my condition from encyclopedias. And the reason they don't want to tell you what's going to happen the day after tomorrow is because it is terrifying to know what... it's terrifying to go all at once from standing on your two feet to understanding that they are about to crack your chest, as they put it so indelicately. So it's easy to say, I will do this but not that. And they understand that, and they understand it very well.
So you have a synthetic heart valve now?
Yeah. And it's not one of the synthetic heart valves, I believe. It's not one of the synthetic heart valves that they've been writing about in the New York Times. One of the awful synthetic heart valves.
Some of them have been defective?
Very defective. People all of a sudden start bleeding out of their ears and keel over dead. Yes,
hey.
Those are very heavy, isn't it? Yeah, heavy. Yeah. No, it's called a St. Jude. It's called a St. Jude heart valve, and who of course is the patron saint of hopeless causes. And I asked my cardiologist. I asked my cardiologist about my valve. And
should have asked him who named it.
Yeah, I asked him after I began to read things in the New York Times about these other horrible and for me nameless heart valves. And he said, "What are you trying to ask me exactly, Jeffrey?" And I said, "I don't know. I was just kind of curious. Do they keep in touch with you the way Chevrolet tells you if if their axle is going to break or something?" And he said, "You mean for a recall or something?" I said, "Yeah, I suppose for a recall, you know, might be something I had in mind." And he said, "Well, I don't know about that." He said, "But I can tell you that I can tell you I worship." That I worship at St. Jude's Parish in Pawtucket, Rhode Island, and I haven't seen any dead people picketing outside. I like the man. Good man.
These essays date back to, I think, the mid-'80s.
Yes.
Yeah. How do you feel about the essays when they're collected in a book? Do they still feel very close to you, or by the time you put them in the book, do they feel like they've receded far away?
Well, in the beginning, when I first began to think about putting some essays together, I knew that I didn't want to have them be literary essays, and I knew I didn't want it to be a hodgepodge. And so I had So I had two or three personal essays, which were autobiographical extensions of The Duke of Deception. And as soon as I knew that I wanted that in some way these, at least I hoped these spoke to one another, I then began to write essays for the collection, if you will. I mean, in other words, they are, certainly they stand alone and they have been published alone, but they were written to speak to one another. They aren't just an oleo or a confection of picked up pieces. And I wanted to write a book that took I wanted to write a book in which I took responsibility for my history after my father's death, that moment in my personal history when I took responsibility for my own actions, and my history was my own making in an existential sense, and so they, I hope, speak to that issue, all of them, one way or another, and to the larger issue of family.
Did you feel after your father's death the sense that you had responsibility for your destiny in a way that you didn't have before?
Absolutely.
Did that dawn on you years later or pretty soon?
No, it dawned on me in a visceral way immediately. There was that extraordinary line in Fitzgerald I believe Nick is speaking of Gatsby, and he said it was only the becoming he dreamed of, never the being. And I realized that from that moment on, it was all being for me. It was only the being I could dream of, not the becoming. That from that moment on, it was really my own. It was my own story, and it was a story that was happening now in the moment. I was both liberated and bereft, if that isn't too theatrical a word.
Well, you know, one of the things you did was to make your father's story your own. I mean, perhaps your best-known book, The Duke of Deception, is about your father, who was a con artist and even conned the family. I wonder if you felt like you had the rights to his story or if you felt uncomfortable about telling it. I mean, in telling his story, you told your own. But you know what I mean. There's things you'd never say about your family for fear of making them uncomfortable.
It's an odd, it's an odd distinction. I certainly feel a kind of responsibility about my wife and my sons that I didn't at all about my father. There are certainly stories that seem to me to belong to them exclusively and aren't my property. Perhaps his life seemed to me to be. As much my property as his, my father's life seemed to be as much my property as his, because the version of that life I had been tailor-made for me. After all, it wasn't the truth; it was a confected version of his history. And the other thing was, of course, he was dead, and there was no one left. To tell it. I should say that in telling. That in telling my father's deepest secrets, I did not feel I was betraying a confidence. On the contrary, I felt really I was bringing him back to life, and that was a benign feeling. It was a pleasurable thing to write about him.
If you're just joining us, my guest is writer Jeffrey Wolfe, and his new book is a collection of essays called A Day at the Beach. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is writer Jeffrey Wolfe. His new book is a collection of essays called A Day at the Beach. The first essay in your collection about how you became a writer was originally published in the New York Times magazine a couple of years ago, in the New York Times Book Review, I should say, a couple of years ago. And there's a wonderful beginning to it in which you're describing a letter that you had written years ago to your brother Tobias Wolff before he had started writing. It was this really kind of pretentious letter that he should at once start reading Donne and Eliot on Donne and Sophocles and Aristotle,
right,
and Racine and Hegel on tragedy. And you wrote, begin at the beginning and familiarize yourself with literature and work through language and time until you learn how to read and may discover whether you wish to write. It's wonderful the way you write about it, how you both agree there's something charming, although pretentious, about it.
Certainly pretentious.
Yeah.
We'd have to start there. I was drunk on literature then, and I was also so self-important about it. After I wrote the letter in my gown at Cambridge, Cambridge University, writing to my little brother and telling him what was what. But also, I was in the middle of a kind of religion of art over there, and I felt that that I had the received word and that I was at the beginning of a calling. The other thing to be said about it is the prose is just preposterously pumped up and extreme. And I wanted to have that be right at the beginning of everything because I wanted to concede what is simply true, is that prose writers, I mean, for better or worse, if I have gotten better, and I think I have, I mean, I'm certainly sure I've gotten better. It's a slow process, and it doesn't come on any of us, easily. I mean, I was a bad writer then. It was bad writing, and I have students now, and I wanted my students to know that.
I think I had teachers when I was in college who really encouraged a certain level of pretension.
Well, it's easy, the whole lecture format is so much like pulpit oratory, and it has those same horrible headmasterly cadences and a kind of rhetorical grandeur which is often unfelt. And indeed, I think it does encourage the worst.
So when you have a student who's obviously talented but is really laying on the pretension, do you talk to them about it?
No, only so far as I'll say ease off a little bit and encourage the student to examine the voice that the student's using and see if she's using a voice that she in fact is comfortable with. But it's possible to be crushing to students. It's extremely easy to be crushing to students. And I was once crushed as a student. I bounced back okay from it. But I don't want to do that. I still am young enough to remember with so much humility how awful my writing was.
What was the crushing experience?
It was an experience when I wrote a first novel. I'd taken a year off from Princeton, and I'd written this horrible, God, I'm spending all my time saying what a horrible writer I am. This isn't very shrewd of me, is it? This is not very shrewd at all. But in any case, this was a horrible novel called Certain Half-Deserted Streets from a line in Prufrock. And I wrote it when I was the engineering communications coordinator of Sikorsky Helicopter Company. Taking a year off from Princeton, the engineering communications coordinator is, in fact, the mailboy. And I'd come home at night and I'd write these, what I thought were elegant Miltonic sentences about this exquisite young man and his exquisite father who was an ambassador to some place or other. And in fact, as I wrote it, my father was in the next room with a bottle of rum sitting watching, he was watching Gunsmoke in his underpants. But I wrote this novel, and I brought it back to Princeton after my year off, and I gave it to my advisor, Richard Blackmer, and I waited for his advice as to what to do with it. And And the two pieces of advice that he might have given me, I thought, were either to send it to Charles Scribner and Sons or to send it to Knopf. Those would, I suppose, be the two choices I had in mind. And in fact, he said nothing. And so after a couple of weeks, which seemed to me long enough, I said, Professor Blackmer, have you had a chance to look at certain half-deserted streets? Oh, he said, certainly look at it. I've read it. Ah, I said, what do you think, sir? And he said, oh, I'd put it in my desk drawer. And I said, and look at it in a couple of months? No, he said, I'd lock the desk drawer. And I'd throw the key away. But, you know, keys can be found. I'd set fire to the desk. So I guess that was crushing enough. But he said it with such goodwill and so cheerfully, and as though this horrible novel that I'd written had absolutely nothing to do with the future at all, that it was just something somebody does when somebody's learning how to write. And I learned how to understand that. But it was crushing.
Are you working on a novel now?
I am working on a novel. I'm at the very, very beginning of one.
So is it coming slowly?
It's coming very slowly.
Is this like a miserable time?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. Because I can't, after 8 books, I still can't believe that it's possible to get to the end of so long a project.
Right. Yeah, I guess it's the kind of thing you could prove over and over and still lose faith.
Yes, actually gets harder, I think.
So who helps you keep faith?
The bankers do. They do a very good job. And then all the coupons that I clip, which are the kinds of coupons you have to send back with your car payments, not the kind that you turn in for cash.
Right. Now, are you teaching through this, too?
Yes, I'm teaching at Princeton this spring, and I'll be teaching at Brandeis in the fall.
As a teacher, you're in a kind of fatherly role, given that your father was a con man, a chronic liar, very unreliable. Do you feel that you've taken kind of more to heart than you otherwise might have that sense of the fatherly role of the teacher?
Well, that's a good question. I don't know how avuncular I am as a teacher or how fatherly. I do know that my father had one extraordinary gift, and that was to be able to talk about difficult things and to talk critically about things I had done without making me feel awful. And there is an art, or at least a craft, there's at least a craft to that. Perhaps it's something as simple as the golden rule is being able to imagine yourself into their, you know, in their shoes, to imagine what it's like to hear hard criticism. And I try and practice that. I try and practice that craft to be candid and hard about the words they write on the page without having it seep into their personal lives, without making them feel lousy about a lousy sentence.
Well, Jeffrey Wolff, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
It's been a pleasure to be here, believe me.
Jeffrey Wolff's new collection of essays, A Day at the Beach, is published by Knopf. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, C is for Clara, who wasted away. D is for Desmond, thrown out of a sleigh. E is for Ernest, who choked on a peach. F is for Fanny, sucked dry by a leech. We talk with writer and illustrator Edward Gorey about his bizarre alphabet books and his other sinister and funny illustrations and stories. Also, classical music critic Lord Schwartz reviews the restored version of Candide, conducted by Leonard Bernstein shortly before his death. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In Tripoli today, demonstrators attacked diplomatic missions of nations that voted for a UN air and arms embargo on Libya this week. The same time, flowers were carried to the embassies of India and Morocco, two nations that abstained in this week's Security Council vote. The sanctions were imposed after Libya refused to turn over several people wanted in connection with the bombings of Pan Am Flight 103 and a French airliner. Libya has now called on all foreign nationals to leave the country. President Bush says that he will comply with request by Congress for records on the cost of presidential travel. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
2 days ago, the White House declined to send any of its representatives to Capitol Hill to testify about White House perks and travel costs. And since then, spokesmen have refused to divulge the exact amount, telling reporters that they can research the federal budget to find out. But the budget doesn't tell the full story. The line item for presidential travel in 1991 was $29,000, but the cost of operating Air Force One alone is $50,000 per hour.
Our budget goes up to Congress every single year. Every once in a while, they go through this dance here. We'll entitle everything. We'll give them full cooperation.
The issue of the cost of presidential travel has dominated recent White House press briefings, and today, spokesman Gary Foster said, it doesn't matter what the cost is. I'm Richard Gonzalez at the White House.
In Moscow, Russian President Boris Yeltsin has removed one of his key economic advisors from the post of Russian finance minister. NPR's Mike Schuster reports from Moscow.
Yegor Gaidar has been the architect of Yeltsin's three-month-old program of economic reforms. Today, Yeltsin removed him as finance minister, but Gaidar remains in the more powerful post of vice premier. Yeltsin appointed Gaidar's deputy at the ministry, Vasily Barchuk, to be the new finance minister. Barchuk was a former finance minister in the Soviet government. Yeltsin apparently took this step to head off an avalanche of criticism expected at next week's Congress of People's Deputies. The Congress has been expected to attack Yeltsin's reforms and demand the ouster of his economic team. But as Vice Premier Gaidar, it appears, remains as Yeltsin's chief economic advisor. I'm Mike Schuster in Moscow.
Striking coal miners in Bulgaria are now back on the job after the government agreed to back away from plans to close mines not making a profit. A union spokesman says it was agreed to do everything possible to attract more foreign companies to update the mining industry and to make sure as few mines as possible are closed. In New York City on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over 15 points to close at 3,234.12 on volume of 185 million shares. Declining issues led advances by a margin of over 5-3. This is NPR News. New York City, an attorney for John Gotti says that his client's conviction on murder and racketeering charges will be appealed. Gotti gained the title of Teflon Don after three earlier efforts by the federal government to convict him failed. The reputed mob leader now faces life in prison for ordering the slaying of his alleged predecessor 6.5 years ago. Gotti's co-defendant was also convicted of murder and racketeering, but acquitted on one count of illegal gambling. Sentencing has been set for June 23rd. Israeli officials have welcomed the State Department announcement that it found no evidence that Israel sold Patriot missiles weapons technology to China. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports.
The clear announcement of the State Department speaks for itself, said Defense Ministry spokesman Danny Nave. Israeli officials felt vindicated that the American team, after investigating in Israel for almost a week, exonerated Israel of all charges.
Publicly, officials said Israel did not want or need an apology, but privately they said Israel's reputation had been damaged for virtually no reason and they wanted someone to take responsibility. Israel also hopes that the announcement about the Patriots will diffuse tensions about other alleged illegal Israeli arms sales to third countries. These charges were made in a separate State Department report published yesterday. Israeli officials have denied breaking any agreements with the U.S., but they also said Israeli supervision of the production of arms systems with American components has recently been tightened. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
The space shuttle Atlantis came back to Earth early this morning after a 9-day space flight. The shuttle landed at the Kennedy Space Center in Florida. The mission was extended for one day in order for the astronauts to make additional observations of the atmosphere. To gain as much information as possible, astronauts in the space shuttle worked around the clock in 2 12-hour shifts. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. There was a young curate whose brain was deranged from the use of cocaine. He lured a small child to a copse dark and wild, where he beat it to death with his cane. Ah, the sinister pleasures of Edward Gorey. He often takes forms you'd associate with children's books and subverts them with macabre images. Gorey is a writer and illustrator. His black and white pen and ink drawings are patterned with incredible detail. When he draws the wall of a gloomy house, the wall nearly vibrates with an excess of pen strokes, making that wall almost look alive. If you don't know Gorey's books, perhaps you know him from the PBS series Mystery, for which he drew the credits. He also designed the sets for the Broadway adaptation of Dracula. Now his books have been adapted into a musical. He designed the sets. Amphigory, the musical, had its world premiere this week in Philadelphia, presented by the American Music Theater Festival. But Gorey didn't come to last night's opening. He rarely leaves Cape Cod, where he lives. So we called him at his home to find out, first of all, why he avoids travel.
Oh, I like to sleep in my own bed, and also I like to be able to just, you know, sort of do whatever I want to. But I have cats, and I think I've inherited. I think I share their predilection for, you know, just kind of sitting around and not doing anything much.
In your story, The Hapless Child, there's a child whose mother dies and her father goes to Africa into the army. And through a series of misadventures, the child is sold to a drunken brute who locks her in the basement and forces her to make artificial flowers. She lives on scraps and tap water and slowly starts to go blind and ends up murdered, ends up killed by a car, I think, by the end of the story. These stories really make me wonder if you were a very well-adjusted child.
Oh, gee. I think I was probably something of a brat. I mean, I was an only child, and I think I was spoiled, rather. For instance, The Hapless Child was originally inspired by a French silent movie. It starts the same way and ends up completely differently. I don't think very much of my work has anything to do with my own life.
Well, I'm interested in what kind of child you were like. If you were very smart and paid a lot of attention in school, or if you stayed home a lot.
I was fairly smart, but I mean I don't think it was so that I was so terribly smart. I think it's everybody else is rather dumber than I am. We moved around a lot.
How come?
Well, I never quite figured it out, but I went to the same place. High school was just one school, but up till then, I don't think I'd been in any school for more than 2 years, and I skipped a couple of grades, so that my grammar school education was rather disrupted. It wasn't that we moved from city to city or anything. We just kind of moved around within. Well, I came from Chicago originally, and we lived on 5 different streets that were just a block. I mean, that were, you know, 5 streets in a row, but we lived on all 5 of them at some place or other for a year or so. I don't know why we moved as much as we did, actually.
Now, you never studied art, right?
Very little.
So, did you teach yourself the kind of detailed pen and ink style that you developed?
Yes, I suppose I really did.
Are you very patient? Because I figured you'd have to be in order to work with that kind of detail.
Yeah, reasonably so. I mean, I remember, well, it goes in fits and starts. I mean, I sometimes think now that I've been doing this for so long, I think, oh, good grief, I've got to sit down, you know, draw. But there were periods, I mean, I know when I was working on the drawings for The Hapless Child, I'd done about, five or six of them, I think, and I was in the middle of drawing the wallpaper on the wall, and I thought, I am bored to death drawing wallpaper on the wall, and I put the book aside for about 5 years.
You see a lot of movies, yes?
I used to. I now see a lot of television.
How come you don't go to the movies much anymore?
I don't know whether it's me. I don't think it really is. I don't think movies are where it's at anymore. I mean, I go on, maybe have been to 2 movies this year, which, you know, when I look back, there was in my heyday of movie going, I used to keep a diary of the movies I saw, not any criticism or anything. I just jot down which movies. And for quite a few years in New York, I used to see over 1,000 movies a year.
That's an awful lot. That would be like three a day, maybe.
More than 3 a day.
So that's
I mean, it wasn't that I was at the movies every day, but I would go on these. I had friends who had collections of movies and ran film societies and things.
Mm-hmm.
We would have 24-hour orgies of movies and things like that, so I managed to rack up an alarming number of them. But lately, I don't know, I go off and I think, I think television is much more interesting now for the most part.
What do you watch on TV?
Oh, everything from mostly trash, frankly. I mean, Masterpiece Theater I usually begin to sort of glaze over, and I switch over to the nearest trashy movie. I mean, there are always a batch of sitcoms that I'm watching. My favorite sitcoms never last very long, unfortunately, but then, for instance, well, typical last, was it Sunday night, I guess, TBS was doing A Doll's House, and there was some trashy movie on one of the networks, and I'd watch A Doll's House as long as I could possibly bear it, and I'd think, oh, dear God, and then I would switch over to the other trashy movie, and then I'd sort of go back to see how A Doll's House was getting on, and I finally decided I really hate Ibsen more than practically anybody I could think of.
How come?
Oh, I don't know. I just thought that I was kept trying to remember what I'd seen Juliet Stevenson in before.
Truly, Madly, Deeply?
Oh, that's where I'd seen her. I'd forgotten about it. Well, anyway, I thought she would drive me absolutely bonkers as Nora. I could have killed her. I could also have killed Trevor Eve, who I usually rather like. I thought I would like to slap those two people right into insensibility. Up until the very end, I thought the last sequence was very good. I like Geraldine James. I thought the doctor seemed to be out of a horror movie. But I just thought, oh, God, really, must we have another Doll's House? I mean, I've watched Claire Bloom stagger through it. I've watched Jane Fonda stagger through it. I've watched Liv Ullmann stagger through it. Who cares?
Did you want to slap the characters or the actors?
Well, I think I dislike this whole, I don't know. I've always been very much of two minds about Ibsen. I think if, you know, when anybody talks about A Doll's House, it's fine. But then there's that stupid plot which keeps getting in the way. I find this true of all of Ibsen. That there's these extraneous, the plots really don't make any, as far as I can see, they'd be much better without the plots, these incredibly complicated entanglements and whatnot. If they just let the characters get on with it. But no, we have to have all these plot things till I get really most annoyed.
Writer and illustrator Edward Gorey is my guest. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Edward Gorey. What's your typical day like?
Oh, my typical day is fighting off several of the cats in the morning and then struggling up and thinking of all the things I should be doing and probably won't get around to. And Well, I try and work every day to some extent. I mean, I do work every day to some extent, but sometimes there are days when I feel like I've been sitting around to, you know, absolutely no avail whatever.
So you live with 7 cats. How did you end up with so many of them?
One thing led to another. I used to, when I was going back and forth between here and New York and everything, I used to try and keep it down to 3. And for a long time, I did keep it down to 3, and then somehow it went up to 6. I can't really remember quite why. And I have been as high as 9. Briefly, I had 9 a couple of years ago.
But you're not one of those cat cartoonists.
No. I draw cats occasionally, but I don't. Actually, most of the cats I draw are anthropomorphic rather than cats. I occasionally put a cat in a drawing, but not terribly often, and I don't. I feel that they're the last mystery, so to speak.
Mysterious in what way?
Well, they just, you know, I think one of the things I like about cats, of course, is they don't talk. I mean, they talk, but you can't understand what they're saying, so it doesn't really much matter. And they have, of course, they sleep 90% of the time anyway, so, you know, most of the time you're looking at a lot of sleeping cats. But then occasionally they wake up and go crazy, and you wonder why are they going crazy, and so forth. And they're all rather affectionate. They, you know, it's company.
A lot of the people who you draw seem strange, odd. Is that how a lot of people strike you in general?
Well, I sometimes feel that with all the practice God has had making people, He hasn't done a very good job of most of us, but the longer I go on, the more I feel it's very hard to the relation between, you know, your work and life and whatnot. I mean, I obviously don't do anything very terribly realistic, but on the other hand, I'm obviously getting my inspiration, or whatever you want to call it, from reality, but the relation is sort of very strange.
Writer and illustrator Edward Gorey. Amphigory the Musical will be performed in Philadelphia through April 12th, presented by the American Music Theater Festival. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. So, Robert, what do you have on John Gotti's conviction?
Well, we should be hearing from Maria Hinojosa, who'd been covering the trial, about the verdict today, finding Gotti guilty of murder. We'll also be hearing today about the attacks on Western embassies in Libya, about Boris Yeltsin firing his finance minister. He remains a deputy prime minister, but Igor Gaidar, the young economist who's been in charge of economic reforms, is now out. And some say that's a piece of political positioning by the Russian president. And also the State Department's finding that Israel was not selling Patriot missile technology to other countries.
Thanks, Robert. Then and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Leonard Bernstein's musical adaptation of Voltaire's satire Candide began life as a Broadway flop in 1956, but the original cast album, which was recorded after the show closed, became a cult classic and kept the score alive. Since then, the show has gone through many drastic changes. A year before he died, Bernstein conducted a restored version in London. That version has been recorded and won a Grammy this year. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review.
Candide is the most ambitious of Bernstein's Broadway scores. It overflows with melody and wit. Nowhere else did Bernstein so effortlessly balance Broadway and opera. The original cast album, which Sony has just reissued in spectacularly good sound, has one of the most brilliant ensembles ever assembled for a Broadway show. Barbara Cook, Robert Rounsville, the irrepressible Ira Patina, and British Shakespearean actor Max Adrian deliver with relish every satirical nuance in the lyrics, which are by a pretty stellar roster of writers: Richard Wilbur, Dorothy Parker, Candide's original librettist Lillian Hellman, and even Bernstein himself. Of course, some of the numbers had to be cut in order to fit on a single album, or were too risque for 1956. In later productions, which were much bigger hits, there were dim-witted plot changes, the political satire was eliminated, and the music was ruthlessly cut and rearranged. Before he died, Bernstein helped put together a version he liked. In London, he finally conducted Candide himself for the first time in his career. That concert version was recorded and videotaped. Now, at last, we can hear all the music and in the order Bernstein originally intended. All is not for the best, however, in this best of all possible worlds. Only one of the restored numbers is really from Bernstein's top drawer, Dr. Pangloss's song about syphilis, Dear Boy. And what contemporary singers could match the original cast? Soprano June Anderson and tenor Jerry Hadley are bland and stiff in comparison. Listen to Barbara Cook as Cunegonda in Candide's best-known song, Glitter and Be Gay. She sings of how she will show her nobility by pretending to enjoy all the jewels that have been forced on her at the expense of her honor. It's a hilarious and dazzling indictment of all hypocritical self-justification and all coloratura sopranos. Cook even manages to give Cunegonda a certain sympathetic vulnerability. Soprano June Anderson on the new recording has a more operatic voice than Barbara Cook, but what a washout. She can't find the right tone, and she either doesn't get the jokes or delivers them with such a heavy hand they're dead on arrival.
Here we go.
The venerable mezzo-soprano Krista Ludwig is very witty and in sporadically gorgeous voice as the old lady who sings Bernstein's own best lyric for the show, "I Am Easily Assimilated." She gets to do a brief duet with another beloved star, tenor Nikolai Gedda. Someone else who gets the jokes is Bernstein's longtime friend and collaborator, Betty Comden's partner, Adolph Green, who plays Dr. Pangloss. But Green never had much of a voice to begin with, and he's now in his 70s. However sly he tries to be, he's really not up to Bernstein's vocal demands.
Dear boy, sweet honey comes from bees that sting, as you are well aware. To one adept in reasoning, whatever paint disease may bring, or but the tangy seasoning to love's delicious fare.
Ironically, Adolph Green undermines Bernstein's effort to make this a more operatic performance, which is yet another problem. Bernstein's own recording of West Side Story, with grotesquely miscast opera stars, was another misguided attempt of his to transform a Broadway show into an opera. Candide, at least, is already close to being an opera. As a conductor, Bernstein tends to underline every note. Sometimes he does this brilliantly, but a lot of this new Candide is inflated and overstated. The final chorus, "Make Our Garden Grow," is still very moving, though. It can support Bernstein's hyper-emotionalism, and it's the last number on his last recording of his own work.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music critic for the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed the new recording of Candide on Deutsche Grammophon. The original cast recording has been re-released by Sony. If you have any comments about Fresh Air, call our toll-free listener line at 1-800-NPR-WHYY. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The archives of the Soviet Communist Party have been opened, and William Taubman is one of the first American scholars to use them. He's working on a biography of Khrushchev. On the next Fresh Air, Taubman tells us what we can learn from the Communist Party archives and shares his impressions of life in Moscow today. Also, a talk with Studs Terkel. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.